Good afternoon, evening, or morning, whatever time you are tuning in to take a listen to us today. I am Chef Elena Alexander, your hostess, as it were, and today we have the unique privilege of getting my older brother, Alan Barnes, who's also a chef, on the line with us, and we're going to discuss some of the food topics that we've had the pleasure of sharing with you along with some of our other guests and the unique perspective of him being my big brother. We'll see how that impacts his answers today. So come on, big brother, introduce yourself to the audience and tell them a little bit about yourself.
Well, let's see. As she said, I am the older brother. I am Alan Barnes, and I have been in the culinary industry professionally since 96, but I've been cooking probably since the age of eight or nine. I'm currently have my own catering business, which is TCS, Total Culinary Services, and pretty much I have the pleasure of being able to cater at my leisure for people. I just like to do small private functions. I really like to do the intimate get-togethers, but okay. Small functions. Small functions like if you want to do something special for that significant other, but you don't really know what to do, well, I'll come in and take care of that for you. Those type of things, or small parties of 6, 10, 12, doing cooking demonstrations for women groups and anybody really who wants to learn anything or learn how to do certain things, and, you know, private instructions as well. So, I mean, that's the gist of me at the moment.
Okay, that's great. So that our audience understands and if you're at all familiar with me, I'm residing still in Chicago, which is Alan's birthplace, but several years ago, he moved to the southern states and went down to Atlanta and has been raising his family down in that neck of the woods.
We're in a place called Lithonia, Georgia, which is 10 minutes tops right outside of downtown Atlanta. People know Atlanta basically by Athens, Decatur, Savannah, and so forth. But, yeah, I'm 10 minutes outside of Atlanta. Been here since 94, I'll take it. Yeah, my daughter was, about 94. Yeah, So we've been having a good time sweltering in this heat of Atlanta.
Awesome. Well, we didn't get snow this year too much up here in Chicago, and I'm not saying that too loud, so that the gods of weather can, you know, smite me and bring me 14 feet in one day. So it's been kind of temperate up here, so I like it that way.
We had snow. Just answer this. Figure this out. We had snow, probably less than an inch, and it shut down all of Atlanta. Everybody runs to the store to buy peanut butter, water, and bread. Peanut butter, water, and bread.
Water.
No. Peanut butter, water, and bread.
Water.
Oh, and milk. Peanut butter, water, bread, and milk, which you, out of all the staples to get, you buy peanut butter, water, bread, and milk. And I keep repeating that, I know, but it's peanut butter, water, bread, and milk. Those are your staples that you're going to survive a winter storm with, which, you know, it's cold enough to snow in the morning, and then you're walking around in a tank top by the middle of the evening. So I don't get that, but anyway.
Well, you know, it's hard for us Chicagoans and former Chicagoans to really understand the panic of the southern soul when snowflakes fall. It doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, me neither, but okay.
Okay, so in the timeline of our history, I entered into culinary school in 1988, and you followed a few years later.
Oh, quite a bit later. You went in 1988, and I was coming out of Champaign-Urbana at that point. I got to Atlanta, like I said, in 90. I married in 92. We were here in 94-ish, somewhere like 94, 95. I graduated culinary school in 96. So, yeah, about 96, I graduated culinary school.
Where did you study? Like, did you, you know, hit the Le Cordon Bleu Atlanta, or if there was one? I'm not even sure if there was a chapter down there.
No, there wasn't a Le Cordon Bleu here in Atlanta at the time. Your choices, basically, the only one that I knew of was the Art Institute of Atlanta. So that's actually where I went. I graduated from was the Art Institute of Atlanta. There weren't that many culinary schools, so the only one that stuck out in mind was the Art Institute of Atlanta. And it's a real the whole way it happened was my mother had been trying to get us to come down here to Atlanta for a long time. So we came for a visit, and you know, we got here. So we came for a visit. We wound up staying. All right, long story short to that part. So to get to the culinary school, she was just like, you know, you like to cook. I'm like, yeah. She's like, would you like a job at cooking? And I'm like, probably not. And she's like, well, let's go for a drive out to this school. And I'm like, I don't want to go anywhere. You know, that whole defiant, I don't really want to be bothered. I'm grown now. You're just my mom. Leave me alone type of thing. And she was like, well, come on, let's get in the car. And, you know, so somehow we are all in the car together, me, my wife, my mom, and my little fluffy baby girl. So we're all in the car, and we wind up at the Art Institute of Atlanta, and we're taking a tour that I didn't know we were taking. So anyway, I realized we were taking a tour, you know, once the woman started talking to me. And, you know, we're looking at all, everybody, this, that, and the other, and I'm just like, okay, I'm not impressed. Am I supposed to be impressed? You know, that whole I'm going to be defiant because this is what you're trying to force me to do type of thing. So I'm just like, yeah, I'm not depressed. I'm not impressed. I'm not impressed. So I'm just walking around, and then the lady goes, okay, so we're starting classes in a matter of weeks. Would you like to take the entrance exam today and, you know, see where you place? I'm like, are you kidding? I said, I haven't been to school since, what, 88? I take an exam now, I'll probably fall flat on my face, and I don't really think I want to take the exam. Why don't I just come back in a couple of days and take it? So she's like, no. The lady's like, well, yeah, but classes are starting soon, and you can start in this semester. And I was just like, oh, how can I get out of this? So I was like, oh, I know. I, you know, thinking my wife would help me. She was like, oh, no, you'll do fine. Take the test. I'm like, thanks. So I took, yeah, basically. So I took the test, wind up actually didn't, you know, tooting my own horn, I actually did quite well. I only missed, like, one question. And so I took some entrance exam, passed it very well, and she was like, okay, you know, you can sign these papers and you'll be registered for school. And I was like, all right, fine. So, you know, I signed the papers, registered for school, and within a couple of weeks I was getting my chef's outfit and a set of knives. And that's how I got into culinary school here.
Oh, okay, cool. I know that here there was an Art Institute of Chicago. There was Kendall. There was Lexington, in which I graduated out of. And now there is Le Cordon Bleu, which is folding soon. And Marvin Morris has a program. Washburn has had a program in Chicago since way before either one of us was born. It is now a part of Kennedy King College. And there's a couple others that I know I'm missing off the list. But what we're seeing, and I don't know if you've been reading in the news lately, the for-profit college model has caused a lot of damage and is consistently being challenged in the courts. So Le Cordon Bleu, Chicago. Le Cordon Bleu, Paris franchised the name, and the company that opened under Le Cordon Bleu had, I think it's close to 500 locations worldwide. The location here in Chicago announced a while ago that they're no longer accepting new students. as of January of this year, following up when the last graduating class walks across the stage, the doors will be officially closed because they're coming under a lot of scrutiny about their recruitment tactics, their promises of transfer credits and accreditation, and the promises of work. You know, you're going to have make all this money as soon as you graduate, and we have a network. We'll, you know, find you job placement. And a lot of the students were bitterly, you know, very, very bitterly disappointed after they went through the program and were saddled with all of the student loan debt. So we're seeing this big shift in the industry, or at least in the educational part of the industry. Has the Institute Atlanta chapter come under the same issues? Because I know the one here in Chicago is either closed or closing.
Yes, actually the same thing is going on here that I know of as far as, now real quickly, the court on blue here doesn't seem to be suffering. They're still commercials for you to join the Cordon Bleu. There's still commercials everywhere here about the Cordon Bleu. So I'm not sure about its status. But as far as the Art Institute of Atlanta goes, its culinary department, pretty much the whole school is supposedly shutting down itself as well. And it had something to do with this recruiting process, though, and not so much a lot of what the other things that you were speaking about. Because, see, I know when I, as part of my first year at the Art Institute of Atlanta, we became junior members of the Fraternal Order of Cooks, or the we became junior members of the Chefing Association. I can't think of the proper names, and I'm so sorry. I haven't renewed my membership, which is probably why. But you become a member there, and as requirements, we had to go to the association meetings when they were held like once a month, and we had to participate in that. And through that, we did a lot of networking, got to know a lot of people that way. So, and as far as job placement, you know, just thinking of some of the things you touched about with the Cordon Bleu, the Art Institute, I mean, my first day there, the head chef there, first thing she told us was that if you all came into this industry thinking that you were going to become millionaire celebrity chefs, she said you need to quit now. She said, because this is not an industry where you can gain the type of fame that you see the celebrity chefs gain. She said that's a rarity. That doesn't happen for all of us. And she said for a lot of you all, this is just going to be this job is a labor of love. It's something you do because you love to do it, as opposed to now because of what you see on TV with all the celebrity chefs and all these cooking programs that you see on TV. People want that fame and glory. She said that's elusive, and you know, and that was back in 1996. Like I said, when I went in, I mean, I graduated in 1996. So back in 1994 when I went in. So I don't even know if I'm answering your question, but anyway. You know, I never went in with the thought of, wow, this is what I'm going to do to become a millionaire in my life, or this is what I'm going to do to become rich. You know, my whole perspective as a man was just a way to do something that I like to do and that I'm good at and that I would be able to support my family with. You know, so we didn't have that issue with the Art Institute. Like I said, and believe it or not, you'd be amazed at how many people actually dropped out of the class from that little speech that she gave us, you know. So, but it is closing here. The Art Institute of Atlanta is closing, and I think it has something more or less to do with money issues than anything else. Unscrupulous recruiting practices that they might have had.
Yeah, that's highly possible, because from what I'm reading in the news, that there have been some significant court cases, class action suits, about this. Also, not directly in the same vein, but here we had at least three different locations under the Westwood College Banner, and they suffered closures because of a challenge that happened just like this, where they promised, oh, yeah, we're going to get you job placement, and then people start checking back in 6 months, a year, and, you know, I'm still working retail sales, but you gave me this certificate in computer processing or whatever data entry or whatever computer language, and I can't get a job. So
yeah,
a lot of that for-profit college thing is really having its bubble burst, and we're seeing a lot of difference.
Yeah, I'm gonna make a statement, though. Probably won't make me popular, but the thing is, though, there are a lot of unscrupulous practices that are being done with these profit schools, because they just want to make money. That's why you have all these associate degrees of schools around. They just want to make money, and that's sad. And see, the first thing, and I've got kids, my kids are in college, and the first thing I told them before they even went into college and before they even decided to pick a degree was find out what you want to do. Figure out what you like. Figure out what you like. Figure out what you like to do. Figure out something that you think you can do every day for a long time, because that's what you're going to do when you get a job. You're going to be doing the same thing pretty much every day for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to decide, you have to look into it. And I mean, pull up the figures, pull up the statistics, because they're there, and figure out how much that job will make. How much does that, what's the starting pay for that job? What's the average length of a person in that career? How long,
mm-hmm.
what kind of advancement can you make in that career? What kind of advancements, how much money you can make, what's the end amount, because there's always a start and there's an end point. So how much
mm-hmm.
is it going to be towards the end? You know, what's the average length of somebody lasting at that point? And then if all of those are something you can deal with, then that's what you move to. And to me, that negates the whole, oh, and then also you need to find out what's the hiring and firing, you know, what's the turnover. And the you know, what's the turnover? Because the rate for the turnover for chefs, very high, very, very high in certain places. I was in a hotel, and within 4 years of being in a hotel, we had 3 head chefs. So, you know, what does that say? You know, 3-4 years, you're in and you're out. You know, you're in, you move on, and you're, you know. So
right.
Those are some of the things. And,
Yeah, absolutely. As a young person coming into the industry, you have to, or any industry, you have to do your research. And I think the 4-year, 5-year lifespan of any particular chef at any particular venue is exactly what we're seeing in the Midwest, is what you're seeing down there. And I think with, you know, I can say with a good deal of confidence, that is almost the industry standard. You're at a spot for a while, and then they kind of want you to move to the next challenge after about 4 or 5 years. And that was actually, you know, I think our industry started that before some of the other industries. So when you would talk to somebody who had been working for Sears and Roebuck or JCPenney retail or software companies, they still looked at it as, I'm going to be here 25 years, retire, and get the gold watch.
Right. Which
that
we
is
know.
Not what happens with us.
Right. Not
that
with chefs. No. Our grandfather, right, our granddaddy, he graduated from what, the CTA. He drove for what, 30-something years, and they gave him what? A gold watch. Right?
Right,
but he was fine with that, though. He was fine with that, and it fed his family. He was able to do what he needed to get done, and the people in his family were able to get what they needed to done. But it's not like that in our industry, and you're right. And see, but you also, now let's attack another part. Let's bring up another aspect of the industry as well, because a lot of times when I'm going around and I see these young guys in there, and these young guys and men and women in their culinary outfits from the various schools, and you know, I'll just ask them, you know, just, you know, ask them questions, and it's like, oh yeah, I plan to open up my own business. And they're like, oh really? Have you looked into that yet? Oh no, I'm waiting until I get through the program. I'm like, yeah, you might want to start looking into that now.
Okay.
I'm like, you really want to take a good look at that now. See, because that's the other thing. I'm all for entrepreneurship. I'm all for that. I think we should own our own businesses because that's one way we get to keep the economy flowing by opening up businesses and hiring other people, you know, who need jobs. Okay, fine. But and this goes for me from when I was opening up my own culinary business. Oh my goodness, there is so much going on that people don't understand. They think, oh yeah, I'll just go pick out a location and I'm open that location up, and then because my food is slamming. Everybody tells me I'm like great. I'm getting renowned. I got all A's in school. People tell me, but that has nothing to do with anything. That's the least of everything else, because
absolutely,
they don't tell you that when you go to the bank, that the first thing the banks are going to tell you is, do you realize that restaurants, catering services are the number one thing that they do not want to give you a loan for?
Mm-hmm.
It's the number one business that they do not want to invest in. They do not want to invest in it. Now, you can go, and even if you go to the local, like I did, the local mom-and-pop bank that said they've been in the neighborhood for 150 years and we like to help our local people, and I walk in, and then you – even throw the race thing in there because they're a black-owned bank and we want to help our people. And you're like, okay, well, I'm a black person. The last time I looked in the mirror and I'm in need and you have a need and you say you want to fill it, then I go in and they tell you, oh, we can't help you. And you're like, really? How can you not help me? You're a bank. You give out loans to people to start businesses. I want a business. I have a business, and I need money to further my business. Oh,
mm-hmm.
Then the first thing they tell you, then it becomes real. And here's the realism of it. Oh, we need 5 years of working receipts where you were in the black, where you were making money. We need to see your books for 5 years. And I'm like, I just started. I don't have books for 5 years. You know, and it's a word-of-mouth business at the moment. You know, and don't get me wrong, people, because there are people who have started like that and they do quite well. I'm just trying to tell you there's a struggle. And unless you can – if you're not married, then you can handle the struggle if you got a family support, either which way it goes, married or not married. As long as you have family support to help you with the bills and everything, and you're willing to go underwater before you raise your head above water, okay, fine. Not saying that everybody will go underwater. But these are just some of the things you don't know. You know, I even tried franchises. Some of these franchises want $150,000 minimum.
Oh, absolutely. $150,000.
Now, if you're just starting out and you don't have $150,000 in the bank, you know, what are you doing? You know, and see, people, they go into culinary school and they see the glitz and the glamour of everybody on television, and, you know, and then they're like, yeah, I'll just open up a business. I'll be the next Guy Fieri. I'll have the next diner or something. And then it's just so many different aspects to it. Real quick story, one of the chefs that hired me, I was blessed because one of my culinary teachers hired me before graduation to come and work with him. So, you know, we got to talking, and he's an old school chef. You know, we were talking and everything, and he was like, yeah, I had my own restaurant. I had a restaurant, and we were doing good. I was doing real well. He said, I'm going to tell you what happened. He said, they put a divider down the middle of the street. He said, and because people had to go down and around the divider to get to me, they decided not to come to me. And he said, oh, and I had good reviews and everything in the newspaper. My food was good, this, that, and the other. And he said, but they didn't want to come around that divider. It was easier for them to stop at a restaurant or someplace that was on the side that they were. So that's another thing, location.
Wow.
You know, location,
oh,
location. You know, so – It's so many different aspects, and we could spend a lot of time on that alone. And I know you don't want to chew up all our time on that. So,
No. It's exactly what I'm experiencing. Here in Chicago, right now I'm educating high school kids in one program and 6th through 8th graders in another. With that, I've met all of these students. Not all of them want to go into culinary. Some of them just want to learn how to cook. That's perfectly fine with me. We can have fun with it. I have had interns at a couple of outlets that I've worked for that were either still in culinary college or just out. And what really made me think hard about the difference between when we went to school and when these people were in school is things like the concept of celebrity chefs and the impact of for-profit college. Those two things brought a lot of attention to the industry, both good and bad. Yes, both good and bad. And, you know, when we were kids, we had PBS, and you could watch Julia Childs or Jacques Dupin or Frugal Gourmet on the weekends, get you a few hours of, oh, look at this, look at that. But that was it. Now you've got a 24-hour cycle of food, television on a single channel, not to mention all the other outlets have at least one or two shows centered around food. I was talking to an intern when I was working for the Chicago Bears at Soldier Field. And in that capacity, of course, you want to get a few students in. You want to, you know, mix it up. They don't cost as much. They get exposure to what we do. We benefit at a lower cost of labor. There was one in particular. Her work was precise and elegant, and I liked what she could do. But she had zero chef persona. And what I mean by that is she was this little petite girl who had this little squeaky voice. And so and she practically everything she said was at a whisper. And I asked her, I said, okay, what do you want to do with your career? You haven't yet graduated. What do you want? I want my own catering company. Okay. How are you going to get that? So I listened to her idea. She was newly engaged. They were going to get married. They were going to do this. They were going to do that. And they were going to do the other. And I said, okay. It doesn't sound completely impossible, but it seemed extremely difficult in my eyes. So I say to her, let's start with a simple thing. You're in a college that's a for-profit module. You want it in, your financial aid cleared. That seemed to be the only criterion of you getting in. You say yes, fill out the financial aid paperwork. So this is pre-game startup prep and all the rest of that. The hotline itself had, I want to say, 20 chefs on the hotline. I was in charge of pastries. That was another set of kids. Then we had another 15 or 20 for the cold side of the kitchen. We had one person that was the dedicated receiver. Chefs didn't even go in and out of the freezer. He received everything for 10-hour shifts a day. And if you needed something out of the freezer or the refrigerator, he had it sent to you. You didn't even go look for this stuff. That's how big and divided that the operation could be. So I say to this young lady in her 20s, and I say, okay, turn around, look down the hotline. What do you see? Bunch of chefs, okay? But more precisely, what do you see? She's like, I don't know what you're getting at. I said, okay, you're 5'1", 100 pounds, with a squeaky little voice, and you're black, and you're female. You want your own catering company? Do you think you could get these 20 guys, 6 foot, taller, 300 pounds, white, black, and otherwise, big barrel-chested guys? Can you give them an order standing where you're at and get them to respond to you? She was like, well, if it's my place, yeah. But you still have to earn their respect. You still have to earn the ability to command them. You say, I need blah, blah, blah. And if you don't hear yes, chef, in resounding numbers where you can tell that most people have responded, then what are we doing? How are you going to lead people who have been in the industry and have earned their place? How are you going to do that? And I don't think anyone had ever asked her that question or anybody had ever even made her think about that. Too many people these days, in my opinion, see culinary television and think of chef as a persona instead of thinking of chef as a duty.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and to piggyback off of that, I understand exactly what you're saying, because it's, you know, you can own your own business, and if they don't respect you, and it is a matter of respect, and let me just from my own perspective of my own history, because when I, you know, I came out of culinary school, so I'm in my mid-20s, and that is not that old, but then again, that's not that young, as opposed to people coming out of their teens, you know, their early 20s. But anyway, if you come down here, so I come out, and now I'm interviewing, you know, and funny thing, I've never been told that I was overqualified for a job until I graduated culinary school. And that's a whole other topic
of
conversation.
Big brother?
Yeah.
Big brother, I'm hearing a little distortion in the signal.
Okay.
Oh,
is
much
this better? Okay.
Much better.
I was just saying, you know, another topic for a later conversation is being told. The second time I was ever told I was overqualified for a job was this culinary position that I was going for. But that's not what we're talking about. But when you go in and you're interviewing, and so when you come out of culinary school, you have the opportunity to be able to interview for positions sometimes that are a little bit higher than just the line cook. So
absolutely.
I went in, and I'm interviewing for a sous chef's position, and this is an executive sous chef's position, but a working sous chef. And you go in, and I'm entering in the kitchen, and the head chef, you know, he's slightly older than I am. He is older than me. He's been there for a while. He got promoted from a sous chef's position to his position. So, you know, we're talking, and, you know, those are some of the – that's one of the things. He's just like, yeah, you know, one of the things he is, you know, he liked the fact that I was a big dude, all right? I'm not tall, but I'm a big dude. I'm wide, I guess, you know. So, and I have a heavy voice, and
yeah,
I talk loud, and I got that aggressive personality that we Northerners seem to have that a Northern aggressive personality. And he was like, oh, you should fit in well here. And then we walk into the kitchen, I'm looking down the line, and there are five or six guys, including the dishwasher, and all of these guys are older than me. I mean, they're 20, up to 20 years my senior.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to come in and command these older men who have been line cooks, ex-sous chefs, ex-executive chefs, ex-chefs, whatever, you know.
Exactly.
And now they're back on the line because you see, all right, that's the other part we didn't tell you. If your career doesn't go the way that you want to go, where do you think you're going to wind up? You know, because to hold on now to an EC or CEC, to hold on to any of those upper chef's positions, you really have to do it takes a lot more. So a lot of these guys, they come right back to where they started, and they're line cooks. And then, you know, you got all of these young guys like myself, we're coming out of culinary school, you know, and, you know, we got to command you, these older men, and they don't want that. You know, you have to be able to step up. You have to be able to put your foot down. But see, it's not just a matter of being able to command with your voice. You also have to show them, man, I got the knife skills and I got the skill set to do what I need to get done, because they will try you. And I have had that done. You know, they will try you. You know, all of a sudden, you know, buddy over there who hasn't called out sick for the last 15 days, or the last 15 years, all of a sudden he's sick on a day when you've got to do, you know, a plating for, you know, 750 people. And now you have to step up and step in, you know. And of course you're going to get challenged, you know. So people don't understand the dynamics of it in the kitchen. You know, they don't even understand. Do you know one of my first interviews, I walked in and they told us in culinary school, when you go for an interview, wear your shirt and tie, wear a decent set of pants, wear your chef's shoes and a chef's jacket. And I was like, why would I wear a chef's jacket? You know, because most interviews you go for, you wear a suit and tie. And they're like, trust us, because you never know. I walk into an interview, and this is just for a simple cook's position, and the first thing they asked me to do, he says, I need vichyssoise. And I'm looking at him like, okay. I mean, I sit down to the interview, and he says, okay, I need vichyssoise. And I said, okay. And I'm standing there sitting there looking at him, and he says, I need you to go into the kitchen and cook me vichyssoise. And I was like, are you serious? And he was like, yes. He says, that's your interview. That was my interview. My interview was to go in, cook vichyssoise, and depending upon how well I did in a timely manner, it being done in a timely manner, it being done correctly, it tasting like it needed to be tasted, plate presentation being there, and all this other, determined whether or not I got the job. I got the job, but that was my interview.
Yeah.
And that was
interview. Yeah, I've had all kinds of different positions, and I've had all kinds of different requirements. I've had a stage at some places, and that involved, initial sit down, get to know you type of interview, and depending on the part of the cycle of the year and how busy they were, you either stage that day, and you, you know, are on a bench with the workers that are already there, and you work a day which for free, which also allows you to learn about them as much as they learn about you. Or you come back at a later date and maybe do a stage. I had a mystery box interview in which, you know, I show up, I know I'm going to cook for them, I know what the thing is, and they hand you a box of food and say, okay, there are two proteins in here, three grains, some herbs, some spices, some fresh veg. Show me what you got.
And you got a half an hour to do it or 45 minutes to get it done.
Exactly, exactly. And I think I always found the mystery box to be a little bit harder for me. Being as I'm a pastry chef, I don't do nearly as much savory as some other chefs now. But, you know, I can hold my own. So that was always unique. Or like yesterday, I judged a scholarship competition in which there are all different kinds of ways to do those as well. So we had Chicago Public School students that have received some culinary training and wanted to compete. Competitions only for juniors and seniors. But the juniors compete, but they don't qualify for a scholarship. This is a senior scholarship program, but we try our best to get all the juniors that are interested to do it junior year so they know what it's like. So when they come for senior year and they're competing for scholarship, it's more set in their head. They've had the experience at least once. So that competition was really narrow. They must prepare a French omelet. You have to do one for presentation and one for tasting. You have to do a molded salad, also one for presentation and one for tasting. And then the day of the event, they're told which two knife cuts that our program director wants them to perform. So they end up with six plates. And it took me a good while yesterday after tasting 10 different omelets and acidic vegetables in a vinaigrette to settle my taste buds back down. It took a while. That having that narrow type of viewpoint, it's a direct comparison between all the participants. The other scholarship program that I work with, it's an open, much more open type of style. We allow them an ingredient list. There's the proteins, this, that, and they bring their recipe to that competition. So we never know until, well, I don't, because I'm not on the culinary portion of that. I don't mentor or train them. I'm the board secretary. But coming into it, I don't know exactly what your recipe is going to be, what you're going to present, and how you're going to do it. So that involves the student's creativity and food knowledge as well as their performance on the items themselves. So there's lots of different ways that we are tested as you know, upcoming chefs and, you know, chefs in the industry for a while. I've had lots of different experiences. But what always used to bug me is, like I said, I left high school in 88. I went to culinary school that year, and I graduated in 90. So at this point, I've seen a lot of different things. And it never fails that I seem to run into the new sous chef, per se, that's come on board. He's been in the industry 2 or 3 years. He was probably the captain of the football team, and his nose is so far up in the air that he couldn't even smell a fart. And you get to talking to him, and they want to boss you around or whatever, but they're not doing it in a way of, hey, I'm a member of the team. It's more like, I'm the new hotness. You need to be like me. And lo and behold, there's always that moment. And I think they're not prepared for what that all means. Because I actually saw one, I think he was maybe 22, young white boy from the middle of the country. And he would say on the floor, well, I don't know Spanish, and I have no interest in learning Spanish, so that's just out. And we were like, well, it's not about that. You do understand that there are quite a few Hispanics that work here, from chef to dishwasher to garbage man to this, that, and the other. And I'm like, it might be in your best interest to at least get familiar with some of the things that they say in their language. Oh, no, oh, no. Okay, well, this got heard, and it had been said on multiple occasions. So this one particular day, the dishwashers, and I'm hearing them, and a lot of people are hearing them whisper to themselves, oh, we finna test this boy. You think you know everything? Okay. So what they basically did was they no longer swept his area. They didn't retrieve his dirty dishes, and they would not wash what he needed. So I'm like, okay, what kind of day are you going to have when your dishwashers won't wash for you?
Yeah.
And they're saying this, and we're getting wind of it. They're openly saying this in Spanish across the floor because they already know that you're not going to be able to understand what they're saying. And they're basically telling each other, man, forget him. Let him sink. I'm not doing anything for him. If he asks me to do anything, I'm on a break. And every other chef in there just watched his ego kind of just deflate for the entire day. And it was just like, yeah, that's what you get.
Yeah. But, you know, oh, man, if you understood the history of this, and I know you do, but you know our history of the culinary arts, it used to be a prestigious honor to be a chef. I mean, so much so, it ranked up there with some of the more prestigious jobs that you could hold. But, you know, going back to La Creme and Gustave Escoffier, and especially Escoffier, because Gustave Escoffier, because he's the one that started the Kitchen Brigade and all of that. But it used to be an all-male dominated, well, actually, it used to be an all-male for one. And it used to be when you cooked in the queen's courts, you cooked for the rich and the famous, and you cooked, and therefore it was a prestigious honor to be able to cook for them. You wore your chef coat with pride.
Right.
Now I can't say so much to that because it's not really, you know, like that anymore, but the whole arrogant attitude, though, is still there. And it – I mean, because the first place I experienced the whole arrogant. Okay, I'm going to start making up words. But anyway, the whole whole arrogant thing where, you know, it was in culinary, my very first day, and we had one of the – she was our female instructor. She's a female instructor. And she just – I was just like, wow, okay. You know, not really throwing things, but, you know, talking down to you like you're, like, lower than dirt
temper
and this,
tantrum.
That, and the other.
I've dealt with certain chefs will throw temper tantrums.
Yes.
As a girl, I have been objectified, ostracized, all kinds of different reactions. And normally for me, because, you know, I'm kind of tomboyish anyway, even though most people don't take that from my looks per se, I've had many occasions where all the guys on staff my first couple of days, they're going to try to shock me with their conversation or, you know, come at me and, you know, flirt to see if I'm going to cave and, you know, try to figure out who I was. And my response was always, your dirty joke will not be as funny as my dirty joke. You need to stop playing and get to work. And they're like, oh, wait a minute. Yeah, I got a backbone. I'm here to do a job, you know.
But you know what? I think that's pretty much any business. So they test you. I mean, when I my first real job at being a supervisor was an overnight receiving manager or an assistant store manager with Walmart, and I got challenged almost every day by the women, by the men, by the Hispanic guys, by the white guys. It was just something it was something every day. And then it was just like, you know, you really don't want to see the part of me that I'm really trying to hold back, because you don't want to see that part. I just want you to come to work, do what you got to do, do it to the best of your ability, do it right, and then go home. And in between that time, we leave each other alone. But, you know, oh, man, it's you know, and in the culinary field, I also dealt, though, with, if we want to talk about some things, I've also dealt with going to places where down here, you know, this is the South, and back in the early 90s, it was still the good old boys clubs. You know, I would go to country clubs, and I knew I wasn't getting a job because there was no one who had a darker skin tone than me there or had a skin tone that matched me there. Everybody.
Yeah, that still happens here. You know, Chicago is still a very segregated city. We have representation, you know, of a diverse, you know, number of different types of nationalities and races. However, certain neighborhoods have been one race since blah, 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 way before, you know, I was even thought of. So historically, you know, there were certain neighborhoods when I was a kid you couldn't go into because, you know, you're not white, you don't go over there, that kind of stuff. That still happened. And I think I had that against me on some occasions, and I also had the fact that I'm a 5'1" female.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm heavier now than I ever was, but, you know, I answered, for example, I was at Roosevelt University studying for my bachelor's in hospitality management. And one of my professors was the food and beverage director at the Palmer House at the time. And him getting to know me in class and other things, and, you know, that I could think well, I knew a lot more about the industry than most of my peers, et cetera, et cetera. He asked me, well, are you working? And I was like, yeah. He's like, well, where are you working? And I told him. He says, okay. Nah, that's not good enough for you. Meet me at my office on such and such day. And I'm like, okay. Not knowing that he meant I'm taking you to the chef and I'm going to make him hire you. So I'm basically on an interview. So I'm like, okay, fancy hotel. So I put on something cute. Okay. You meet him. We sit down. We talk. He gives me a tour. He takes me to the executive chef and says, hire her. And the executive chef's like, okay. He's like, what are you interested in and what have you been doing? And I'm like, well, I've been working pastry, you know, almost exclusively for about a year now. And I went to culinary school and da-da-da-da-da. He's like, okay, I have room in the pastry shop. Do you want it? And I'm like, okay, let's give it a try. So he finishes touring me through all the kitchens, and there are multiple ones in that hotel. And I could hear the Hispanic bakers, you know, hey, who's that? Hey, what's going on? I was like, okay. So I met this one, that one, the other, and I was given a start date. A couple hours into my shift, the assistant executive chef, which was one of the few other girls that worked there, was a older Romanian woman who spoke English, Romanian, and Spanish. And so as she's getting to know me and, oh, yeah, you tell me about, you know, where were you here before here and blah, 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 general conversation. Then she chimes up because most of the guys were Hispanic and most of them spoke English and Spanish. But they were kind of quiet because they couldn't really figure out, you know, what was going on and why I was there. And she asked Savala, hey, Savala, tell her what you guys call her. And I'm like, what? And I was like, yeah, they gave you a nickname when they first saw you on the tour with Chef. And I'm like, okay. And my nickname was Chula Narga. Chula meaning cute, Narga meaning what you sit upon. They had nicknamed me cute butt.
Yeah.
And I was just like, oh my God, like for real, like seriously. And I was like, all right, I'm okay. I'm like, I'm okay with that. You know, I'll play along. That's okay. There could be worse things you can call me, right?
So, oh yeah. I was just gonna say real quickly, if you don't learn the commands, then you need to at least learn the negative words. So I know I've learned the negative words.
You learn the negative words. You learn words for certain things. You learn basic sentences. Like if your dishwasher says, I need to change my address, you need to know what he's talking about. And I'm not saying that they're not going to try to meet you halfway, but, you know, showing them that little bit of respect for them and what they do is critical. Because they're trying to learn, and they're trying to work, and they're trying to feed their families. And if you show them, if you show the dishwasher respect, then everybody else responds to that as in you're not dismissive or elitist and all these other things. So from day one at that job, my nickname actually kind of got shortened down to Chula. I was Chula all the time. Hey, Chula, do this. Okay, cool, no problem.
but it's still
very sexist, very male-centered, very testosterone-driven. And then the negatives can be very long days, end up resulting in a high abuse of alcohol and prescription and street drugs. And, you know.
Well, you know, the people. Yeah, because there's so much going on, they also don't tell you that people in the culinary industry, they suffer from depression, they suffer from anxiety, they suffer from fatigue, stress. It's one of the highest. There's a high suicide rate in it, and there's a high divorce rate in it, and there's a high rate of infidelity that goes along with being a chef.
Yeah, if you're working 18-hour days, and you have
a short day.
Right. But, you know, to other people outside the industry, they don't think of that as a short day. But you're in the trenches with this core group of people that you see every day, day in and day out. Your spouse does not see you more than a couple hours here and a couple hours there until you get a day off. So you're in this bubble, and you end up forming this whole other family just for the people that you work with. So if you're raising kids, your kids kind of see you. Even with my own kids, like, I don't work those long days anymore, but I still work odd hours. So if my kids got a band recital, you know, on a Thursday evening around 6:30, I'm not able to go. I'm at work. So you end up with these stressors, and you also end up with a lot of chefs that end up marrying each other after either being cheated on or cheating on their mate.
Yeah.
And I see you every day, and we get along great, and da-da-da-da-da, but then those relationships aren't really lasting either because you're almost, you know, competitors almost.
Yeah. It's hard. Yeah. It's kind of hard because unless, you know, you're both running a business together and you're doing front, one is just strictly front and one is strictly back of the house, or one is strictly front of the house, or one is just doing the major cooking and the other one is dealing with the finances or something, or dealing with the books. You know, it's, you know, it might work that way too. Some seem to work that way. But yeah, it's sad. But as far as the nicknames go, at least my first nickname was Cherry Boy.
Cherry Boy?
Yeah, Cherry Boy.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what did they mean by that?
Well, just because to them I was to the guy that nicknamed me that, he had been in the industry a whole 2 years prior to me. And he was a sous chef came out of the same culinary school I came out of, and because I had really no prior experience going into the culinary field, I came out and, you know, my first line cook's job, he just called me a cherry boy. He's like, oh, you're a cherry boy. And, you know, after a long debate with this dude over what the true meaning of that word is and what he meant by it and whether or not I would accept it, it just came down to being, that's what I'm going to call you, cherry boy. And I was like, yeah, we just see how much times I answer to that one. But okay, you know.
Right. But, you know, I've been put in situations that are, you know, I don't know, to a culinarian is not that unique, but to people outside of our industry, it very well could be. You know, I had a job at McCormick Place. I was 22, 21, and I was in charge of 35 very grown men. I did all their schedules, all the rest of that, and I had to command them, and they had determined that I was just some cute girl that somebody hired and that I wasn't going to take this seriously, and they thought they could just disappear and go sit down on an extra break and, you know, go hide in the locker room on me, and they found out very quickly that, no, I take my job seriously, and they were just, you know, floored, like, this girl is just, man, like, I don't know how to take you. And I'm like, don't take me anyway, you know, but don't make the mistake of thinking I'm not going to call you on your bad performance. Don't think that's going to happen.
Yeah, but you know what, that can go both ways, because I walked into a kitchen as a sous chef, and the sous chef, the executive chef they had got promoted from the sous chef position, and I walk in as a sous chef, and it was just, oh, I want to use another word, but I can't use that word term. But it was just, it was terrible. And because the least, you know, here's the thing. There's one thing to have your, and for the lack of a better word, subordinates.
Mm-hmm.
This one thing to have your subordinates respect than to just think that they're your friend. And because that's pretty much, I walked into a situation where, you know, they didn't respect him, but they were more like his friend, and they didn't respect him. And then I found out later why, and that's another story. And I was just like, wow, you know, because he didn't. So I get there, and to them, I'm standoffish. I was like, oh, you know, I'm having a party. One of the people, I'm having a party. I'm like, okay, good for you. And it's like, well, no, would you like to come? I'm like, no, I don't really associate with people that I work with outside of the job. You know, unless it's a job function that the job says I have to be there. And I learned the hard, and you learn. And I didn't learn the hard way, but I learned because I watched other people go to people's houses, and then they don't know how to control themselves, and they say something or do something, and then it comes back to bite them at the job because it's like, oh, yeah, remember the time you came over to my house and you said so-and-so, or you hit on my 13-year-old niece? I'm not doing this, you know? Which actually was something, you know. But, you know,
yeah,
so.
There's that element, too. I had a job. I was a manager, so I was doing a lot of front of the house kind of things. And, of course, I had odd hours. But the food and beverage director kind of required, couldn't purposely require, but socially required you to finish your last shift and join the rest of the crew at the local bar. And at the time, there was only one other part of one other or two other members of management that had kids. And my kids were small. And I'm like, look, that's great. I'm glad you invited me. But after I get off a midnight shift that ends at 2 a.m., I'm going home because I only have 4 hours before my kid is up and wanting breakfast and, you know, all of these other things. And she actually stunted my career with that company because, I wasn't a get-along type of girl. And
they don't understand that it's not that you don't get along. It's just that I have a life. And I've got a life, because I mean I've actually you talk about people don't understand the hours. You know, I got to a place where I was working and it was like, oh, wait a minute, you know how to do banquets? I'm like, yeah, I know how to do banquets. Oh, well, you know what? We fired a banquet chef. I'm like, oh, why are you doing that? Well, you can do banquets now. I'm like, oh, well, how much more am I getting paid for that? Oh, no, we're paying you a salary. That's all inclusive. I'm like, no, I don't remember reading that in anything that said that was all inclusive. And then you get to the point you're a salaried person, and you know hourly employees, they're just like, hey, we got to cut time. Y'all go home. Who's going to pick it up? You're the one that's picking up their hours. Now, and next thing you know, your 8 o'clock day, which you never guaranteed an 8 o'clock day, is now 12 hours. Oh, well, okay, so I get to go home after these 12 hours. Like, oh, no, you know, so-and-so called out for the night shift. So now you got to cover that shift too, you know?
Yeah.
I've literally walked into work at 5, got to work at 5:30 in the morning on Monday and left at 2 a.m. on Tuesday.
Yeah.
Only to turn around to come back at 5:30 on mm-hmm. Tuesday morning.
Yeah.
You know, and people don't understand those type of hours, and that's how it is when you're salaried. Now, hourly, yeah, no, because it's time and a half and all of that type of stuff. But
yeah,
I just
but
wanted
it depends
to make
on where you're at.
It does. It does depend upon where you're at, because I did work for a woman who she had a catering company, and then she had a cafe and a catering company. And what she did to get over was you did your first 40 hours under one company, and then she put your other 40 hours as to the other company. So
oh,
she just paid you straight time. So you never got overtime.
Okay.
Never.
Well,
and we bumped heads because she was like, I need you to not go to school this semester. And I was like, you got to be kidding me. I said, she says, no, I need you to go. We're coming up to our busy season, and I need you to be here. And I was like, well, you know, you can also hire more people because there's a ton of kids in culinary school who just want to work, you know, part-time. You can hire a bunch of kids part-time for what you're getting ready to not pay me. And she was
right.
Like, well, you have to make that choice. And I was like, well, my choice is I'm going to culinary school, so I'm paying for that, and I've already started the semester. Had you came to me before, I wouldn't have done it then. I didn't like her. But had you came to me before, I probably would have considered sitting out a semester or at least, you know, that time when you needed me. But I was like, no. So she was like, well, I'll tell you what then. You have to come earlier in the morning. And I'm like already going – I have to be at school at 5:45. So she was like, you come in at 5 in the morning. So I'm working 5 in the morning to 5 o'clock in the evening. And she would put the first 8 hours under one business and the other 8 hours under her other business.
Man, yeah, I've run into all of that. There is a significantly large off-premise caterers here in Chicago, and a lot of the chefs that are, you know, in the industry and of quality have been there at least for a short period of time, and almost everybody I know knows this company. And, oh, yeah, I worked there 3 months. Oh, yeah. This company is of the mind frame as we walk in the door and we stay until it's done. And they don't
yep.
care if it's 20 hours. They don't care if it's 8 hours. The only people that really doesn't get, like, the big, you know, stink face about leaving are those that are actively in culinary school. Any other reason for you to go home? I'm like, dude, I got to go. I'm not feeling this. I'm tired. I did 18 hours yesterday. I just finished 18 hours today. I got to have a day off. They're like, but we're not done. And I'm like, but
yeah,
you have
yeah.
other people. And I don't care. I got to go. You know, nope. They will pay. They don't care how many hours you log. They will, as long as you're here, I'll pay you until it's done.
Yeah. Yeah. That's yeah. Well, you know, there's another big Marty company out there that back in the 90s that I worked for, they treated you the same way. I literally did 120-hour work weeks for this company, 120-plus-hour work weeks for this company. And when I wound up literally getting sick and the doctor was just like, dude, you need at least a couple of days to recover. I walk in, I tell the guy, I said, look, doctor says I need just a couple of days to recover. I've been working 120-hour work weeks for you for, like, the last 4 months. You know, I just need 2 days. And
right.
his answer to me was, if you can't handle it, maybe we can find somebody that can. And I was like, wow, okay. So I understand what you're saying. So I calmly gathered myself, walked out the door, called my wife, told her what was going on. She said, do what you got to do. So I walked back into the door, looked the manager in his face and told him, okay. And he said, okay, what? I said, okay, do what you got to do because I'm taking 2 days. So, you know, but, you know, back to the culinary thing, it's just, you know, people don't really understand a lot of the hours that you put in. And it's even more hours when you own the business. And it's even more of a headache when you own the business. And it's because, you know, it's just more to it when it's your business, your restaurant and everything. But anyway, I have to say something, though, because, you know, it's not all fun and games for us men either. You know, when you're dealing with a kitchen, and I've been in kitchens and I've had like a majority of the cooks were women, and I was just like, okay, that's cool. I can deal with women. I don't have a problem with them. I like them. They like me, some of them, not all of them. A few of them. Okay. So I'm good. And you walk in and you're just like, some of the conversations, I'm just like, did I walk into the locker room at, you know, am I back at school in the men's locker room? Because they will talk about things. And I'm like, wait a minute, whoa, you're old enough to be my grandmother. Why are you talking about these things? You know, and she's like, I'm not your grandma. And we're just having a conversation. I'm like, wow, really? This is what you want to talk about right now. And then you're dealing with, from the perspective of being a manager, I got to go home because my kids are sick. I got to go pick up my son from school because this, that, and the other. I got to go do this. I got to go do that. And you're just like, okay, you know, I can't stop you because what can I say to you? You tell me your child is sick and thrown up at school and has got a fever, but I need you to be here to plate this 750 dinner that I got coming up. I can't stop you, really. You know, and I can't threaten you with your job, you know, which as a man, I've had that done to me.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I've had it done too. You know, when I was young and athletic and healthy and, you know, wanting the money, yeah, there were many occasions that I worked a 20-hour day back to back. The first time I really started doing that was when I was working at McCormick Place doing conventions. And you would have weeks off or, you know, days off in between shows, but ramp up to a show in the first day of the show, yeah, it's 18, 20 hours back to back to back. And
oh, yeah.
I passed out one day, not knowing I'd passed out. When I opened up, my grandmother was staring at me, and I'm like, why are you here? And they're like, because they called me to come get you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm like, why? Yeah, who are you? Why are we still in the kitchen? I'm like, no, Alan. You're in the emergency room. Oh, really? What's going on?
Right.
You know, yeah, well, I've been down. I've been down that road. Yeah, I've been down that road.
Yeah.
You know, and there's nothing you can do to prepare for that. You know, and see, I find it a little bit interesting, a little bit different though, because even when you know, it's kind of like I was working. I worked for Walmart. All right, and I was a store manager there, and we would ask who would want to do overtime. Now, I'm not going to lie to you. Overtime was fine because, okay, you got time and a half. That's when they were paying it, time and a half. And, you know, any woman that said, no, my husband says I can't do it, you just were like, okay, fine, you can't make them. But they also don't realize that they go on the list of you're not getting promoted, and if a promotion comes up, you're not going to get that. If a raise comes up, you're not going to get that. And if we need something done special where you might get extra, we're not going to consider you for that either, you know. And I mean, that's real life. I mean, that's just real life. But see, something happened, and I'm like, my daughter is sick, and I need to go take care of her. You know, she's got she's running a fever. Dude asked me, I mean, literally, the lady that owned the catering business, she seriously asked me, well, don't you have a wife? I'm like, yeah, what does it got to do with anything? So send your wife to go get her. Ain't that her job? I'm like, well, no, it's kind of like both of our jobs because we kind of both were making that baby together, at least that's what I thought. So I really pretty sure it was part of my responsibility to go get her. And I was like, I got to go get my daughter because I'm 20 minutes away as opposed to 45 minutes away, and I need to go get her. And she's like, Alan, I don't know what to tell you. And so she just walks away from me. So I walk over to the head chef, and I'm like, dude, my daughter's sick. She's running a fever. It's like 94 degrees. And he's like, dude, why are you standing here talking to me? He said, just leave. We'll take care of everything. Mm-hmm. You know? So it kind of,
Huh?
Hello?
Okay.
Yeah, hello? Can you hear me? Uh-oh, you're fading out. Hello? Hello? Hello?